Hello and welcome to News Club. I'm your host Em, and this is where we talk about the news and what to do about it. I'm joined once again by Devs and Chivers, and today we're examining two significant events: the acquisition of Tribune Publishing by a multimillionaire investor and the arrest and sentencing of climate activists planning a protest at Manchester Airport. So starting off, in June 2025, eMedia Group, the parent company of Islam Channel, acquired Tribune, Britain's oldest democratic socialist publication, which has been running for 88 years. Muhammad Ali Harath, the founder of Islam Channel, will serve as a chairman for the newly acquired magazine. Tribune was founded in 1937 and has historically supported the Labour Party from the left, supposed left. It has featured contributions from notable figures such as George Orwell, Anira Bevan, and Michael Foot. The acquisition of historically left publication by multimillionaire media owner raises questions about the influence of wealth on media independence. Even when they identify as progressive, their ownership can lead to subtle shifts in editorial direction, potentially compromising the publication's commitment to radical critique. So we're going to explore this a little bit more, and I'm going to now go to you, Chivers, to tell us a bit more about what we should we be focusing on when it comes to this story. Why did you bring it to us?
Yeah, so I think this, you know, from when we're recording this takeover was only really announced 2 days ago. And just in that time, there's been a lot of commentary and criticism and discussion about what this means, not just for Tribune, but broadly for what does it take to own and publish and sustain a socialist or leftist or progressive publication in the media environment we have in this country. And I think, you know, as a socialist magazine, which has only quite relatively recently been revived or kind of revived itself on the basis of being a reader-funded, independent alternative space for radical commentary and critique, I think this does bring up really interesting questions about where does the left or socialist media go from here amongst all the other dynamics we've talked about on this show, about like collapsing funding models, challenges from billionaires, the crap state of online platforms as a way to try and attract and retain and market your stuff to readers. And I should say as well that there are kind of two sides to this story, and I don't say that in a glib way, but more to point out that in a lot of the commentary and critique of this, there has been some real hypocrisy in how it's been reported, particularly from GB News and the Daily Telegraph, who have picked this up as a kind of gotcha about like, oh, look, Britain's oldest socialist magazine has been bought out by an Islamist terrorist with links to Tunisian radical movements. And, you know, they've picked out a very basic sort of Wikipedia summary of Muhammad Ali Harath's background. So yes, he runs the TV station Islam Channel, which did very recently get censured quite heavily by Ofcom for broadcasting what it found to be a very anti-Semitic program. So that's not good in general, but I mean that channel's been broadcasting for 20 years, so to only have one major complaint in 20 years, albeit about an anti-Semitic program. But like, when you compare that to GB News, who doesn't have a particularly shining regulatory record in what it's been broadcasting in just 5 years, I think it's interesting to note the hypocrisy there. Also from the Telegraph, in complaining about particular kinds of owners taking control of media outlets, the Telegraph has just been bought out in a 15% stake by a UAE government-backed funding source. So there's a fair bit of like quite obviously racist and Islamophobic seizing on this news about the particular owner that Tribune now has. And they're doing all these things of saying like, well, it's the home of Orwell and British radical critique and literary, and now it's been bought out by the enemy within. So, you know, keep an eye out for what is obviously like racist gloating about what is happening to Tribune magazine or what could potentially happen. The second side to the story is then this broader question of like, what does that mean for the sustainability and future of socialist media in this country, which I think it'd be really interesting to discuss here. Is just there are so many different dynamics in what it takes to get people interested in any kind of media, let alone socialist radical alternative perspectives. I think Tribune has always been a really interesting place for socialist commentary, alternative and radical ways of thinking about problems we have in society, really interesting literary and cultural critique, particularly in its like revived state over the last 10 years. Obviously, you can go back and look at all of the kind of world historical stuff that was being discussed in the magazine in the 30s and the 50s, CND, anti-fascism, anti-Stalinist leftism, all those sorts of really interesting historical things. But even recently, under its more kind of digital reader-led model, it's been a really interesting space. The question is, what does this tell us about the literal financial sustainability? How do you pay the people that make this? There were lots of criticisms around when it was revived by the owner of Jacobin, which is the sort of US equivalent, much newer, but equivalent to Tribune, and how the owner of that was found to not be paying their writers very well and not supporting a particularly ethical or sustainable model for supporting socialist writing and journalism.
Would you say that a publication can maintain its radical slash socialist ethos when this structural change has occurred, regardless of how that multimillionaire might lean in their political affiliation?
Yes, I do think it is possible, but it takes a lot of safeguards and a lot of promises and a lot of sort of hoping for the best, right? I think what the new note in the statement that Tribune have put out from the new owner, they have basically said the independence of Tribune is assured, which is a very sort of easy thing to say and a lot harder to do in practice, as has always been the case with any kind of medium, whether they're a millionaire, a billionaire, a multi-billionaire, or just like a rich person who owns a newspaper. It's actually very difficult in practice to assure that kind of stuff. So I think it is possible, but like, you've got to put your mouth where you've put your money, right? You've actually got to commit to these things and say publicly, these are the assurances I've given the editor and the staff of Tribune in terms of what I, you know, my hands-off approach. Here's how I am guaranteeing their independence. Here's what I will allow, well, not what I will allow, here's how I will ensure that my role as owner is completely separated from the editorial and political outlook of the magazine. Here's what I will do if it is seen to have been breached, if that relationship goes sour. Here's what I have pledged to do. Here's what I've put in writing to the editors and to the readers of what I will do. And I like that. That's difficult to maintain, but like, that's a bare minimum starting point for if you are an ostensibly progressive owner of a magazine with a very open socialist tradition, and one which very recently has tried to go on a more reader-led model. You've got to put those assurances in place, and you know, readers and staff have got to demand those kinds of assurances and say to the owner, okay, we accept that this is the financial situation we're in, but you've got to give something back to us in return and make sure that you show you're committed to these values.
Yeah, we were all at the Media Democracy Festival on Saturday, run by the Media Reform Coalition. And I was doing a session with Priyanka Raval from the Bristol Cable. And she was saying that one of their mottos is, you buy in, so we can't sell out. And they are majority supported now by reader subscriptions. But I think there's something really important there. Obviously, the Tribune has now got this owner that means it's going to be in less financial difficulty. It's not going to be dependent on subscriptions in the same way. But how do you build that relationship with your audience that means that there's actually just this level of transparency and scrutiny that means that they, if the thing, the leverage that they have on you is no longer financial, what could that look like? How can they actually be both informed and create a structure that means that it's not now down to like, you know, some like backroom conversations between the owner and the chief editor that is deciding the direction of travel, whether this is actually something which is happening in a public forum, then just means that there's this level of accountability that can happen in that collective space rather than this thing that can just sort of get hidden away in like a little room with the powerful in it, which is obviously the complete opposite of the socialist tradition that the Tribune is part of.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, that Cable comment about like, you buy in so we don't sell out, I think a lot of people are rightly quite angry at the sense that when Tribune was revived via Jacobin 6 or 7 years ago, where they said, we want to come into this with a reader-led approach, and so you will have a buy-in. As a subscriber, we will keep the socialist traditions, we will make sure that our financial sustainability is built on attracting readers and reflecting their views and interests and keeping up the traditions of the magazine. Lots of subscribers have helped to rebuild Tribune, and now that project, it feels like it's been sold off. And people are quite rightly angry, putting aside all of the politics and the suggestions of independence or interference or who the new owner is, just that sense of like, this thing that we built through our contribution and our stake and our collective participation in it has been sold off. Like, that's quite a really direct feeling of economic and loss of ownership and power. And yeah, I think the way around that has to be that readers and subscribers and contributors and the staff and the editor make this point of saying, we want real assurances that, you know, where you say you support the progressive and socialist agenda of Tribune, that isn't just a statement of things you like and what you want to read about. It's your statement of how you want to run and own this place as an independent, ideally hands-off owner.
Immediately, I'm already thinking also about the quality of the content that's even produced to begin with, and the fact that like part of that quality is determined by what you actually want to read and what you actually want to consume, and with in having a buy-in, then being able to dictate what that is and what that looks like, right? But the other thing is like this notion of sustainability and the fact that like, given that that was essentially that model of buy-in was present before, prior to this buyout. What does that say then about the sustainability of news media? And like, what does that also say about the kind of effectiveness and tactics that we should be taking? Because, you know, we clearly prefer this model, one that is adopted by the Bristol Cable, but it has failed here, arguably.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's failed, because as far as I'm aware, like, Tribune had quite a stable subscriber base. Now, I don't know what's gone on behind the scenes where the previous owner, the kind of Jacobin trust, Jacobin business that was treating Tribune as a kind of subsidiary of that project, I obviously don't know what the kind of financial situation was going on behind that, whether the Jacobin people found that this wasn't a going concern and they didn't want it anymore, whether they felt that their priorities were elsewhere, whether they just wanted a quick buck and someone came in and said, would you be interested in selling Tribune? I don't really know. But my sense has always been that as a marginal but very interesting space for the kind of content that Tribune puts out, it's been a good space. Like, it's given a platform for lots of really interesting writers and thinkers. It's basically done what it set out to do, albeit not on a kind of mass utopian scale that we might like of this kind of media. So yeah, I'm not too sure. I think it will really depend on what happens next with this new owner, and if they come out and say, my job is to really like double down on the reader-led strategy, I want to put my money into advancing advertisements, making the magazine a bigger space that brings in more readers that then makes it more reader-owned, or if they simply say, I want to treat this like any other media business, bring in lots of advertising, which in turn changes the output, because advertising isn't about selling content to readers, it's about selling readers to advertisers, and that's a very different economic relationship in how media's run. We'll have to wait and see, but I think, yeah, in terms of what it means for left and alternative publications, it's a sort of sign of success that Tribune was able to revive itself and be an interesting space, but also a real demonstration of the threats and challenges that are there. And I don't really have an answer to how to get around that right now, because, you know, the cable took a decade to get into the position it's in. And it's incredibly successful, but it's successful partly because where it is in Bristol and the kind of cool vibes that Bristol has, because of the incredible network of like cooperative and community-owned things that were already there, and how the cable fit well into that space, which might not be possible in other places. It's
so like what we're alluding to there a little bit is like a cultural change, essentially.
Yeah, partly. And I think as well, like a lot of the other new left and socialist media outlets that have been set up, most of them primarily like YouTube channels or commentary spaces or podcasts, have tried to follow the same approach. And it's obviously very different dynamics when you're doing a podcast or a YouTube show versus putting together a quarterly magazine filled with very long but very in-depth and interesting think pieces and critiques. So there's stuff to think through there of like, what do we actually, it's not just a case of like, I've set up a socialist media, but like, what do we want people to get from it? How, you know, quarterly is probably the best you can hope for in the current information economy, the attention economy, whatever they want to call it, like a quarterly magazine of really long think pieces about socialist agendas. It's probably the most that we can manage as a very dilapidated and weak-minded human species at the moment, right? So it's that distinction between what is sustainable financially, but also what is sustainable for like what people want from a socialist media. What do they actually want to digest and consume and get involved in? And that's, again, something that the readers and the staff and the editor of Tribune will have to impress upon their new owner.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, I mean, again, in that session on Saturday at the Media Democracy Festival, there was also Aaron Bastani from Navarra was on that panel. And there was a bit of discussion about whether Navarra might move to a more reader-centered approach, like way of doing things. And there are a few like technical things getting in the way of that. But I think a big one is when you're trying to do something that's kind of national, and you're trying to speak to, you know, millions of people across lots of different spaces, well, then the way that they're going to be communicating with each other is online. And the structures and the things that we have for people to talk to each other are mostly set up to just not generate good conversations. The whole structure of them is there to like, yeah, create polarization and one-upmanship and the loudest voice, you know, dominating all the others. And because at one point Aaron was kind of trying to say something about audience capture, or like, you know, what do we do about the fact if we've got like a sense as a team that like the political strategy needs to be here, but we're getting loads of pushback from people on our social media and our audience thinks this. And I was like, I don't think you know what your audience thinks, because some of your audience is talking to you on social media, but most of us actually aren't. Also, it's not just about them talking to you. It's about them talking to each other and being able to make the case to each other. And actually, I would have really appreciated, especially with this stuff around Brexit, the opportunity to engage with other people within that Navarra landscape who were really strongly pushing on a second referendum, who were saying, like, we have to try and undo the result in some way, which I definitely thought was madness. And most of the people around me thought was madness. But there wasn't.
Can
really
I know why you thought it was madness?
And look at the country now and see what it was like when a whole entire side of politics tried to overturn a referendum, and what that's led to now in the whole prospects of our democracy. Debs was right to think that at the time.
But it was also because going into the referendum, none of the kind of corner of the left that I was part of were going into that being like, I'm voting to remain because I love the EU.
Yeah, I love Erasmus.
Most of the people, like, I honestly was just like, this is a stupid question and you're going to get a stupid answer. And now we have to live with the stupid answer.
But and yeah, also not like, then saying that, oh, because we got a stupid answer, everyone who gave it is stupid, which was the political response for what we've had the last, 9 years now.
Whatever answer you gave was going to be stupid.
Wait, how long ago was that? Stupid.
It's 2016, 9 years. Literally 9 years coming up, right? Or just gone. Was it like June 6th, June 8th or something? I can't remember, but it was June 2016.
Going back to the Tribune, if you want to have this more reader-centered model, how are those readers actually communicating with you and with each other and creating a sense of collectivity, of buy-in? Whereas with the cable, you know, they're in a particular place. People can come to a building. People can come to meetings. There's a material connection between people. You know, they'll do coverage of protests that people will have gone to. They'll be covering stories that are really live for people in the community. And with the Tribune, that's just never going to be the case because it's trying to talk across lots of different places. And I think that is a really important piece of infrastructure. But for something like that to be meaningfully reader-led, we actually need a different kind of digital space and digital forum for people to be able to have more generative collective conversations.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's that whole collaborative notion, because all of these sort of new socialist or left-wing publications, whether it's the YouTube channels or the magazines, all have as their kind of masthead, we are against billionaire ownership, we are for a more socialist media. But then they sort of sit within their own silos and want to develop their own approaches. And very rare, I mean, more recently, but very rarely is there any kind of partnership and collaboration and interaction between those different spaces in the way that a socialist organization of a society or economy should ostensibly work. This is the thing we kind of promote and want to see across the society and the economy. So why aren't we doing it in the media space? What I found really great at the Media Democracy Festival is that we had Turned Left there, who very kindly used us as a space for their first kind of live show, and, you know, bringing in, you know, interviews with other outlets who were there, or speaking to journalists, or having Aaron Bastani from Navarra on to have an interview. And I'm like, that's the beginning of what I'd want to see from more of this space of socialist and alternative media, is not just we've set up our own space and we're saying that we're the alternative and we've got our business model and it's reader funded and so on, but actually like platforming and bringing in the other voices and the other outlets and becoming a more combined and collaborative space. Because that's not just good from a like business perspective of promoting your platform with other platforms and kind of having this more distributed and disaggregated network of this is the left media and the left media is cooperating with one another. You don't have to agree with what all these other platforms are saying, but you can at least recognize that you are all, you know, independently owned, reader-led, socialist-facing outlets.
Speaking of, I have often found that the easiest way for me to find like independent media just listed is if I go to the IMA website and I look at their membership. So it's the Independent Media Association. And it's like, if I just out of curiosity, I'm like, let me find some relevant independent media. If I need some kind of outlet that's related to a particular thing, sometimes it's in the name, sometimes it's not. But a good few of them are listed on our members section of the IMA website. So check that out.
Absolutely. But yeah, just to really cement Debs's point of we've got to try and get these spaces talking to one another and actually be becoming spaces for people to talk to one another about what do we want a left media to be, how would that work, how would it operate, rather than them being kind of siloed one-way directional megaphones. It's like we're providing a space for the left to talk to one another.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Chivers, thank you so very much. And if you want to be supporting more radical independent media and checking them out, like I said, IMA and ICNN, the Independent Community News Network. So next discussion, Manchester Airport protesters jailed. So in August 2024, four activists associated with the environmental group Just Stop Oil, Indigo Rumblow, Margaret Reed, Lenora Ward and Daniel Noor, were apprehended near Manchester Airport. They were found carrying equipment such as bolt cutters, angle grinders, glue and sand, along with high visibility vests and instructions for interacting with police. Their plan was to access the airport's airfield and glue themselves to the taxiway to disrupt operations. In May 2025, all four were convicted at Manchester Minshull Crown Court of conspiracy to intentionally cause a public nuisance. Sentences ranged from 18 to 30 months in prison, and each was fined £2,000. This incident raises concerns about the criminalisation of protest and the expansion of state power. Does this set a precedent where the mere intention to protest becomes a punishable offence? And really, yeah, Debs, tell us, what did you want to talk about when it comes to this story?
I think I wanted to talk about this because it really shows how far we've come in terms of restrictions on right to protest and civil liberties in this country. When I was first a kind of climate activist in the late 2000s, you could not go to jail for climate protest. There were members of Plain Stupid who went onto runways repeatedly and they never got put in jail. They would be given massive amount of community service. That's how they were being punished. And they might be given bail conditions that would bail them away from people. But jail was not a thing that they wanted to do at the time. I think it was seen as something that would make people into martyrs, like kind of raise the profile of what they were doing rather than actually quash dissent. And then even in like 2016, I was involved in an action at City Airport where we went on the runway and we shut the airport down, and none of us got even community service for it. We all just got suspended sentences. And this was absolutely to do with the racism of the courts. We were white bodies on the runway for a Black Lives Matter action, and we would not have been treated nearly the same if it had been black and brown bodies on the runway. But even under Theresa May as Prime Minister, they did not want to put people in jail. And then the following year, you had the Stansted 15. So this wasn't an action for climate. This was, it was a kind of joint action. It was an action against a deportation flight, and they were using a tactic from climate activism, and lots of the people in that had previously been involved in environmental actions. But this was really trying to highlight things around the hostile environment. And then they experienced a much more heavy-handed response. They were convicted on terrorism charges, but they still were not put in jail, and their charges were eventually overturned. And now here we are in 2025, and you've got four activists who've been put in jail for significant terms just for thinking about shutting down an airport without even managing to do it. And I think the difference is actually that this stuff is really like taking off. It's not like a minority pursuit anymore. There's actually lots and lots of action happening. And the judge in the judgment said this thing of saying, the principle of deterrence when sentencing cases as serious as this is of particular relevance and importance to prevent social unrest arising from the type of escalating illegal activity that all of you have become involved with. So he's seeing it as, I'm sentencing you because I need to deter other people from doing this thing. And he's trying to frame it in terms of public safety, because he's saying, if you carry on doing this, there will be unrest. So yeah, he's trying to make it into like, you're doing this bad thing because you're going to provoke other people and create unrest. And obviously he's completely writing out all of the violence of climate change and environmental destruction, all of the violence that airports are associated with all around the world. But yeah, I think that thing of back in the late 2000s, jailing someone for this kind of thing, it wouldn't have been seen as a deterrence. It would have been seen as potentially encouraging the action because it was raising the profile of it. Whereas now it's like, we're going to put you... I was looking up average sentences. The average sentence for a violent offence against a person is 22 months. One of these people was in jail held for 24 months, literally for just walking around with some bolt cutters.
I was literally thinking that someone from our city who has committed some of the most horrendous crimes is a paedophile and was only sentenced for 40 months. That's a paedophile for 40 months. That's only, what, 16 months more than this, like, quote-unquote, highest offender, right? Like, that is fucking insane, by the way, apart from the fact that he deserves more time. These people don't deserve any time. And the other thing actually being what distinguishes lawful protest from criminal activity and the kind of boundaries and the way that, as you've pointed out, the boundary itself has shifted over time. Like, what does that really say about the law? What does that say about the state? What does that say about the courts?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the line between what is a legal action or a criminal activity is determined by, in the court, by a judge or a jury. And yeah, for sure, this space has been getting kind of smaller and smaller, the space of something that's considered legal. So you've had new sentences, like new forms of criminality created. Like, it used to be legal to walk slowly. There's an offence for it. They've also created new offences that mean that something that previously might have been prosecuted as trespass would now be prosecuted as disruption of critical national infrastructure and having, you know, a much higher penalty for that, including jail time. And then they've also been doing all this kind of interference with juries and refusing to allow certain kinds of defences to be made to juries. So that's what you've seen in a lot of the Palestine Action cases, where they want to be able to make this defense of, like, I caused this harm to prevent a greater harm. I smashed this window to prevent these arms being sent to Israel. And they've literally been prevented from making those cases to juries. So yeah, you are seeing this narrowing of the space. And at the same time, it's important not to romanticize the past. I mean, it was bad under Thatcher. It was bad under Blair. It is bad now. Part of the reason that we're seeing this escalation is also because there is actually more protest happening. There is more activity and there is more resistance. In the late 2000s, being a protester, doing this kind of action, like, you were just like, there was no cultural sense that this was something that normal people got involved in. You were a really, really tiny minority. And now there is just much more of a culture of resistance. And I think that we do need to remember that the backlash is actually in response to a big mobilization.
Did you ever mobilize, Chivers? Were you one of them lot?
I wasn't, no, rather embarrassingly. I mean, I very rarely mobilize out of this chair. You're seeing me in on this call. So, I think Debs has covered it so well. And it's that notion that these actionists, not even actionists, you know, just activists have been sentenced on the basis of planning to do something or thinking about something. And those remarks about it being a deterrence, again, not to romanticize, like, the criminal justice process or how previous actionists and activists have been jailed or detained or sentenced for stuff. But, like, the idea that they've been sentenced not for committing a crime, but so that, as like a kind of message to others, seems so much against these vaunted principles of the justice system as being, this is a punishment for a crime you've committed, rather than we are using you as a scapegoat to prevent others from doing the same. That sounds really bad. And not good. And I feel like a lot more sort of liberal jurisprudent purists should be speaking up on this. It's like, you don't have to support what these people are doing to recognize that, like, this is a really, really bad lurch towards authoritarianism through the courts in action against protesters and people making a stand against things. And we've also seen the other day, there were two people sentenced. I don't think they were jailed, but they've been, like, found guilty of harassing an MP. Basically for going up to her in the street with leaflets saying, do you support the genocide in Gaza? And the MP has turned around and says, I was absolutely terrified. I thought this was a public security issue. I had to get police escorts to follow me around. And now those two activists, who, as far as I can tell from the reporting, just walked up to an MP and said some things very loudly to her about, do you support the genocide in Gaza? What are you going to do about it? They've now been sentenced for public disorder and for harassment. And it's like, the basic act of holding your MP to account, whether in person or whether online, is also being stripped away at the same time as all these actions being rolled back. So there is a real total full frontal assault on basic expression of opinion, even before you get into the action people might do to oppose the genocide in Gaza or to act against the climate catastrophe and companies that are causing it. To think about it, to say something about it, is now being criminalised and treated as terrorist behavior or, you know, harmful conduct. It ain't good.
It ain't good at all. And as we know, it sets the precedent for what liberties can be taken away for other groups of people. I think, yeah, it's good to remember not to silo the issue. But I'm actually quite curious to know, what does that actually say about the way we live, about the state itself? What does that say about the surveillance and the authoritarianism, which is slowly becoming more and more evident.
Well, you know, the collective that wrote that book, Empire's Endgame, a lot of what they're talking about there is how, you know, the British state, I mean, certainly in the last 100 years, has sort of operated as this system of carrots and sticks. And since the creation of the welfare state in particular, there's this idea that, like, the state gives you some things, and then in return, you comply with its demands. But in the last 15 years, the carrots have got like fucking small and the sticks have got really big. And yeah, a lot of what they talk about in their book, it's a really, really good book, is, yeah, what does this relationship with the state start to look like when it's just based on quite blatant coercion and not on like, this is the give and take that happens between us. And so, yeah, I mean, in this case, they will say, oh, like, we're protecting the public. You know, they'll claim that, like, they still care about civil liberties. But, you know, we always have to weigh up these different things. And, you know, we have to take these actions to, yeah, to look after, like, the poor, innocent public. There was in the judgment as well, the judge said, he said that they were different to people who engaged with civil disobedience and accepted the legal consequences. I assume by this he means because they didn't plead guilty, and says the stance taken by you distinguishes you all from others who have chosen to follow the long and honourable tradition of civil disobedience on conscientious grounds. This is what they do all the time. They're always like, past protesters good, current protesters absolutely terrible. I remember in the late 2000s when Ed Miliband was the chair of the Department of Energy, what was secretary of whatever, the leader of the Department of Energy and Climate Change. And he said, we need a movement on the scale of the suffragettes to fight for climate change. I was literally part of a suffragette inspired climate action group. And we did a protest in Parliament on the 100th anniversary of a suffragette action to raise awareness about climate change. And we all got arrested under SOCPA, which was this law that the Blair government had brought in, which said that you couldn't hold a protest within a mile of Parliament without a permit. So, like, they don't want an actual movement on the scale of the suffragettes when it actually happens. They just want the kind of branding of the suffragettes. You know, it's the same way that they talk about Nelson Mandela and the anti-apartheid movement. Now it's like, oh, he's a statesman. What an amazing person. You know, at the time, or Gandhi, you know, the British state hated Gandhi. And now he's like the paragon of peaceful protest. So, of course, there's always going to be this way that, like, they will say that they care about civil liberties and ultimately they care about power. But clearly, as the, yeah, as this relationship with the state has become more and more the stick and not the carrot, actually what that creates is obviously more resistance, because there's fewer people that are bought into the system, and then you have to continue, then you have to hit them even harder, you know. So that seems to be the cycle that we are currently in.
And should we get used to that cycle? Do we, is it worth, like, should we normalize? I mean, we've spoken about how it's not valuable to romanticize the past because it never used to happen. But is there something to be said about the transformation of organizing? Would you say that there were good, bad things that came out of it? Would you say it's all very circumstantial? How do we move from here?
I mean, we shouldn't normalize it, as in we shouldn't accept it, but we should anticipate that this is the direction of travel, because the fundamental problems are not going away. And in fact, they are going to get worse. And so I think it's much more about how do we figure out ways of organizing under an increasingly authoritarian state, and, you know, kind of use the window that we have right now to be doing some strategizing for how we keep going. If Farage is prime minister or whatever, like, that's, and there is a lot of kind of thinking and support out there for people that really want to understand what their rights are in relation to protest, because obviously it's a constant moving target. And with a lot of these things as well, like, they'll pass a law, but then you don't really know what the law means until people start going through the courts with it. And that's what's starting to happen now. I mean, organizations that you can go to and look at to know more about your rights and to know more about the situation for protest. There's obviously Green and Black Cross, who produce, they've got a protest laws guide and do Know Your Rights trainings. There's Article 11 Trust, who do a lot of research into this kind of constrained space. There's NetPol. There's a site called Free to Protest UK, which does a lot of looking at surveillance of protesters and helping people to know what kind of technology does the police currently have and how can you protect yourself from that surveillance. I mean, if you join activist groups, probably they will have some practices around digital security. If they don't, then you should probably start a conversation about how you're going to do that. But things like using Signal for messaging, using Proton Mail for emailing, and yeah, having protocols around how you make messages disappear on Proton Mail. And all of this stuff is like, you know, at least with the people that were jailed for this airport action, they were clearly on their way to doing it. Whereas, you know, there was that meeting that, you know, the way that Roger Hallam got jailed was he was literally just in a Zoom call discussing something. So yeah, that was a failure of their digital security that meant that those people all got targeted in that way. And so, and yeah, you just should not be talking about things of that kind online. Like, that's just really, really bad practice. And I don't know why nobody had schooled them in this beforehand. So yeah, we need to practice these ways of keeping each other safe. And partly what you get is this mismatch of knowledge where people that are coming in quite new often don't have a sense of what could get them into trouble. And so for people that have been around in this thing for much longer, there's quite a big responsibility on us to kind of, you know, find new people that are coming in and explain, like, this thing might seem really innocuous to you, but actually that could get you done under this, like, conspiracy to cause a public nuisance. So just be really careful about what you're saying. Be careful about having disappearing messages. Yeah, there's a... And actually, if you can create that kind of culture, then yeah, you are all protecting each other by taking those measures. Sometimes doing random shit is a good idea. Like, keeping them on their toes, meaning that, like, they cannot follow your strategy. That's actually quite a good strategy. I was at an event the other week, a book launch about a book called Transfemme Futures. And the writers are Nat Raha and Meike van der Drift. And yeah, they were just talking a lot about organizing on kind of transfemme principles. And Meike was saying, for example, she's an academic and she's part of her union. And she was like, well, we kind of came, we, you know, everyone had different ideas about the strategy. And none of them were like really any better than any of the others. So we just decided to like use this person's strategy one week and this person's strategy the next week. And like, actually, that worked really well because the bosses had no idea what they were doing. And it also created a really strong sense of the group and people having agency and having buy-in. I was like, God, that's really smart, actually. So yeah, I think a bit of like nonsense that makes them that ties up the state and makes them deeply confused.
That's really interesting. Like, as a strategy in and of itself, it's like a strategy is to use multiple strategies. That's brilliant. What you alluded to earlier as well, actually, I wanted to come back to that, which is like this disconnect that there is between like older activists and new people. It feels like we really lack the infrastructure, almost the conversational infrastructure, to bring people with 20 plus years of experience to people with, I don't know, 20 days of experience. Like, how do we actually close that gap? Because it really wasn't until like 2-3 years into activism that I was actually directly talking to not just adults, but the kind of adults I want to be talking to, if that makes any sense, right? Because there are adults in these spaces where, like, or at least tangentially connected and related to like youth spaces and youth organizing, youth activism. But it's almost like they're not the right adults, at least from my experience. Like, it really wasn't until I was in the right place at the right time with the right people and coincidentally, like, da 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 da, that I was like, oh, okay, now I'm in contact with people that I'm like, I can learn a lot from you. But that was just my experience, and that took time beyond just having resources that we can give people attention to, because I can enter a space in which I can tell there's a lot of new activists and activism and be like, hey guys, here's some readings that I think would help. But I think that's very different from being like, hey guys, I brought a person who knows a shit ton of stuff, ask questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways this is like the $1 million question, and maybe it just kind of loops back to what we were saying before of like, I think independent media, especially ones which allow like their readers and their members to talk to each other, could play a really crucial role in this, because then you're And you know, this is kind of what we want in news clubs, right? Like people coming together and talking about ideas, but you've got something to talk about together that's not just like, not just your identities or, you know, tell me your political analysis. It's like, let's come together and talk about this thing. And then in the process of talking about it, we will end up sharing things about our identities and about our political analysis. And I definitely, I mean, it is weird being like, I am now an elder. But in some ways, you know, you've also been doing this for like quite a few years now. You've got way more than 20 days experience. And sometimes it's not about your physical age, right? It's actually about how long you've been doing something or how long you've been thinking about it. I definitely really, it's been really nice in Sheffield actually since moving here. There's a lot, it feels like in a smaller city, there's actually more connections between people of different ages and less just like only ever organizing with people my own age.
That's really nice. That's really refreshing. What about you, Tom? Do you organize with people across generations?
No, you're asking the wrong person. I'm stuck to a desk, but I really like the notion of like a bit of nonsense as a really positive approach to thinking about organizing and doing stuff and try, because like whatever kind of line of politics you're in, if you're trying to change stuff, you always come up against barriers, whether they're like state barriers or barriers in ways people think. And actually, just rather than trying the same thing over and over again, even if it seems to be working, I think just like coming in with different approaches, partly to just befuddle and confuse the people you're going up against, to annoy them or like, you know, disrupt the way things work, I think is just really interesting. So that was cool to hear about.
I could just end on a story. At climate camp in 2010, when we were camped outside the Royal Bank of Scotland in Edinburgh, the headquarters, there was this big day of action and it was so weird. Some people had built this sort of tower thing and they'd also built like a kind of papier-mâché rhinoceros head on the front of this tower, and then everyone just sort of dressed up and then gradually moved very slowly with this tower down the hill, and then came up to this like big metal wall that the police had made many hours before, and then when we got there it was like, oh, I guess there's nothing we can do now. Like we all knew that this was this completely futile thing, but you could definitely see the police all being like, what are they planning? What is going to happen? And of course, like, I mean, nothing happened, but we did waste a lot of police time.
And would you say like that was then useful or like almost like a good misdirection for something else? Or was it just kind of like, well, we have a rhino head?
Yeah, I think it could have been more strategic. And yeah, there was a lot of miscommunication that happened over the course of that week. And also it was an interesting transition moment. It was the summer after the coalition government had just come in and austerity had just been announced. And there was a kind of general understanding that this like single issue climate activism needed to do something different, but we hadn't quite worked out what. But I'm pretty sure if we'd not done that, they wouldn't have put so many police on and we wouldn't have wasted so much time.
So there you go, guys. Diversity of tactics. Thank you guys so much for joining us on this episode. It's been good to hear about it. And once again, always going to point to things that already exist and things that you can be part of or just give your attention economy to. The IMA, the ICNN, and of course the legal support that we get. Well, also be mindful of your different local region, e.g. nation within the UK, because we have different laws depending on where you're based. So definitely be attentive of that as well. Thank you for coming along. Check out previous episodes where even more smart things were said, and we will catch you next time. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.